Okay, the House Resources Committee is called to order at 1:02 p.m. Monday, February 6, 2023. We are in Capitol Room 124. Present is Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, and Representative Rauscher. I expect Representative Puckettuck will be joining us soon. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. And do I need to recognize anyone else in the audience? No. Okay. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Justin, and our moderator, Zach, for helping keep everything in order today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Before I do the formal opening for our meeting today, I just want to say a couple words. We just got word today that the Willow Project has been approved, at least at the BLM level, and I think that's really good news, and it's something we can be excited about. It's on the cover of the Petroleum News, so I should have brought it. It's in my office. Anyway, did you know about that, Commissioner Boyle?
I knew about the final supplemental.
Okay. Maybe that's what it was. But it was pretty big news, very positive step towards having a project in NPRA go online. Okay, so the only business on today's agenda is to hear from the Department of Natural Resources regarding its Cook Inlet gas supply forecast. As I'm sure everyone is aware, South Central Alaska is on the precipice of a potential energy crisis regarding gas. In my opinion, this is one of the most pressing issues Alaska faces today. I've invited the DNR to talk to us. They will share a little bit about how the DNR analysts view this issue. Leading the conversation today will be John Burdick and Johnny Meza from the Division of Oil and Gas. Also with us today are Commissioner Designee John Boyle, Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, and DOG Director Derek Nottingham. So Mr. Burdick and Mr. Meza, welcome to the House Resources Committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Well, good afternoon, Chair McKay and honorable members of the committee. It's great to be in front of you again this afternoon as we present to you our 2022 Cook Inlet production forecast. And I'll frame it off before I turn it over to the experts here with just a few, you know, high-level remarks. You know, it's worth keeping in mind that the Cook Inlet has been producing oil and gas now for over 60 years. In fact, it was the discovery of commercial quantities of oil and gas in that particular basin that provided the impetus for the state to become a state. And so we've seen for the last 60 years, you know, successive waves of companies coming in and developing resources in the Cook Inlet. And a happy byproduct of all that has been an ample supply of natural gas that has powered homes and businesses across South Central for decades. You know, oil and gas, like every other natural resource, is by definition finite. So the longer that we produce from these fields, the less resource there is ultimately to recover. And we're getting to a point in the Cook Inlet where a significant amount of the commercial quantities of oil and gas have been recovered. And as a result of that, you'll see in the forecast that we're presenting, you know, in a number of years, we see the potential for demand for gas in the Cook Inlet to outstrip supply. And I think it's important to keep a few things in mind. First of all, you know, our models, of course, are as good as the data that underpin them, in which I think, you know, we're very confident in the inputs to our models. But they really do just offer a snapshot in time. That is, you know, if multiple variables sort of hold constant over the next few years, then, you know, we do anticipate seeing a shortfall in gas supply for Cook Inlet. However, if any of those variables change, then, you know, the overall equation could change. But I think, you know, it is worth noting that because Cook Inlet gas supply has been underpinned over the, you know, these multiple decades by the oil that has been found and produced in the basin, the less oil and the less economic oil there is to find and develop naturally kind of leads to less activity, you know, associated with finding and discovering and marketing more gas. And so, you know, we do face, you know, that particular challenge as we look at, you know, what are some of the options that we have as a state, as policymakers to help, you know, change some of the variables in this equation. You know, I think it merits the committee looking at things from a short, medium, and long-term perspective. There are certain levers that can be pulled that could help, you know, change the scenario up in the short term. But, you know, I think medium and long term, again, since we're dealing with what is ultimately a finite resource, you know, we do have to look forward to a future where we look to different energy sources or different mechanisms for delivering same energy resources so that South Central continues to enjoy, you know, abundant and affordable energy. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Johnny Meza and John Burdick, who are two folks within our Division of Oil and Gas who can walk us through the study and help us understand more about some of the issues that we're facing there.
Good. Thank you, Commissioner Boyle. I'd like to recognize Representative Puckettuck, who arrived at 1:06 p.m. Thank you, Representative. Mr. Meza, are you first? Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair McKay. We're going to provide some background information in this presentation, starting with the geology and then some more information about the supply and demand evolution and the tax fiscal system that existed for the past two decades. And then we're going to turn over to discussing more details the outcomes of the study. And with that, I'm going to have to turn it over to my colleague, John Burdick.
Good afternoon. For the record, John Burdick speaking. I'm just going to briefly touch on the Cook Inlet geology. So there's two main sources from where we produce gas from the Cook Inlet. One primary is being biogenic gas from coals, and that's mainly from the shallower strata, if you refer to the lowermost figure. And second, in the deepermost strata, is oil migration from source rocks, thus creating associated gas.
Johnny Meza, for the record. Moving on to the next slide, we have information about production of gas in Cook Inlet. On the left side, we see a graph of production coming from state lands only and organized by producer. One of the main takeaways of this graph is at the earlier part of this graph in the years 2000, most of the production was generated by major companies such as ConocoPhillips, Marathon, Unocal, Chevron. That picture changed for the later part of this graph in the recent years, where most of the production is generated by independent oil and gas companies such as Hillcorp, Fury, Chugach Electric, Vision Resources, and so on. The right graph on this slide provides the same information about production, but now from state, federal, and private lands. And one thing to note here is the level of production in the earlier part of the decade, in 2000, reaching over 200 billion cubic feet per year. And we will see in another graph, in another slide, that was more than enough to meet the current demand for consumption of Cook Inlet gas in the basin. And we can also observe the decline at a basin level, the decline in production in that graph and how that has been stemmed in the later part of that graph. Importantly to note here as well is the contribution from major fields such as MacArthur River, North Cook Inlet, Beluga River, and Kenai, accounting for 75% of the production in the earlier part of that graph, but with important contributions later of new fields such as Kitchen Lights, Kenai Loop, that started their contribution to gas production in 2015.
Okay, any questions? Oh, okay, please continue.
Thank you. On this slide, we present more detailed information with respect to the production of gas and oil for 2022. This contains information for the first 11 months of production. And the important element here to note is the contribution by Hilco of Alaska in the gas production, accounting for approximately 85%. And in the case of oil as well, it represents a significant contribution to the production of oil in the basin. Another thing to note here is the contribution of kitchen lights with close to 4 BCF to the supply of gas in the market.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Real quick one through the chair, Johnny. Is there any trend? Did the first discoveries happen south and we migrated north to find more gas or search for gas or north to south? And just kind of what's the trend line for how this basin has been developed?
For the record, John Burdick speaking. Most recently, it's primarily on the eastern side of the inlet. That's where a lot of this development has been spurring as of late within the past 5 to 10 years, roughly. On the east side of Cook Inlet, west side, those are much more mature fields with respect to the ongoing and newer developments on the eastern side of the inlet.
And just to share, why is that? That's just where they happen to be discovering, be drilling and discovering, or?
Commissioner Sadler, through the chair, I would just say, you know, the Swanson River field on the kind of northeast of this map, I believe, was really one of the first fields in development. As you can imagine, that's in proximity to, you know, early and pre-statehood homesteading activity on the Kenai Peninsula, and the initial exploration for gas being facilitated by the onshore accessibility of it. Offshore development followed, and then as, you know, the market has developed and there's been an increased interest, this, for the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. There's been an increased interest in looking, you know, further, certainly on the west side of the inlet where there's more infrastructure, we might see more exploration activity there. And so it's a product of infrastructure. It's a product of need and desire to explore further areas, increased understanding of the geology of the basin, if that helps provide context.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you, Chairman Kay. Johnny Mesa for the record, Department of Natural Resources. On this slide, we're going to provide information regarding to the demand of Cook Inlet gas. This graph provides a decomposition by use related to the commercial use, electric power use, and residential use in Cook Inlet. As you can see, those three layers provide a consistent representation of the demand for Cook Inlet gas throughout this period and lately accounting for close to 80% of the total demand for gas, Cook Inlet gas in the basin. This graph also shows information regarding what the demand used to look like in the early 2000s, especially when focusing on the demand side from the Kenai LNG export facility, which had its last export cargo in 2015, and now turned from an exporting facility to require permits to import LNG, liquefied natural gas. The other major source of the demand in the earlier part of that graph comes from the fertilizer plant that was operated by Agrium and ceased operations in 2007, and now it's being owned by a subsidiary of Agrium with the name Nutrien. This is important as well because you can see that in the earlier part of this graph, referring to the production information that we showed before, that production used to be around 200 billion cubic feet per year, and that was more than enough to meet the local needs of the gas demand in the basin, and therefore producers even exported that gas outside of Alaska.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, you know, sometimes the numerology of the units confuse me. When I look at your slide 6, that the demand for Cook Inlet gas was up to about 210, looks like, billion cubic feet, and then you just said a second ago that Department of Energy has authorized import of 1.8 billion, I think, and that's sufficient. That's on slide six. Yeah, I just want to make sure that. So it sounds like in 2020, FERC approved imports of 1.8 billion. And what does that represent about historical production or demand in the Cook Inlet region?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct. Their current operator of the LNG facility has requested to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to change the permit to export LNG into an importation of LNG. And it currently has a capacity, that facility, to import up to 1.8 billion of cubic feet. Now, that hasn't yet started. That hasn't materialized. The operator of that facility has yet to make a decision regarding whether to import liquefied natural gas or not. And with respect to the demand, that used to be, the intent of the graph is that the export, the LNG facility used to be a major contributor to the demand for Cook Inlet gas, but with the change to a import facility, that will no longer be the case.
So if I'll follow up with me.
Yeah, Rep. Sadler, please.
So 1.8 billion is way, way down in the weeds and the just the, you know, static at that bottom. I mean, that doesn't represent very much of the demand in the Cook Inlet. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it is very small, but it's not, the 1.8 billion cubic feet does not refer to Cook Inlet gas anymore. It refers to the importation of gas coming from outside of Alaska.
Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to make sure I understand this correctly, is this 1.8 billion cubic feet the only spot that we have to store natural gas should we need to start importing it?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, for the record. The permitted capacity for that facility is the FERC authorization for regasification, so where you take LNG, liquefied natural gas, and turn it back into gas that can be shipped through, you know, the pipeline system in state. And so it's not a representation of the storage capacity that either is at that facility or could be built at that facility. It's the capacity to do that regasification. There also could be additional capital investments that could expand the ability to regasify and store more natural gas, either as LNG in the storage sense, or as natural gas in, say, a subsurface storage facility such as sinks of the Cook Inlet natural gas storage facility that currently exists.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up, if I may, through the chair. If I was doing my math right, we use about 70 billion per year, and so 1.8 is like a 38-day supply. What is the potential? I know that's what's permitted, but how much space is there that we know of?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, I don't want to speak to it incorrectly off the top of my head. There is subsurface injected natural gas storage capacity at the Singsa field that is significant and currently plays an important role in the regulation of gas supply and demand throughout the annual swings of a given year. There's efforts underway in the department and with operators to expand gas storage. And there's also the possibility for entirely new gas storage, to expand gas storage in existing fields that have limited or depleted original natural gas resources. There's also the ability to expand those subsurface facilities, but we can get back to the committee with the specific capacity of Singsa and that are under consideration in those other facilities.
Thank you for the clarity. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rep. Armstrong. That's the exact question I had, is how much gas does Singsa hold, and seems like we should be filling that back up as soon as possible. 1.8 billion per year is a little less than a month's supply, I think, if I do my math correctly. But neither here nor there. So we do have a FERC permit to bring LNG in, or that's in process, that permit. The FERC permit to bring LNG back to Cook Inlet.
Chairman Kay, I believe the operator, a subsidiary of Marathon Oil, has requested to FERC the permit to import LNG, but the operator has still need to find more information regarding its final investment decision to embark on that operation.
Okay, because the slide says the FERC permit's been approved at $1.8 billion. Is it hard to increase that amount if we had to?
Chair McKay, this is John Crowther again for the record. It's my understanding, we'll confirm for the committee that amount has been issued and approved by FERC. There would be a process if we wanted to expand that authorization through FERC, the owner of the facility would have to pursue. It's also the case that, as my colleague Johnny Meza mentioned, the operational and capital commitments to fully utilize that 1.8 and to subsequently utilize additional volumes have not been undertaken by that operator at this time. Okay. So there's been some regulatory approvals, but there still has not been commercial and operational approvals.
Okay, and just because of my curiosity, I can't stand it. My first well I drilled in Cook Inlet was in 1980. The Sinksa field, which field is that? It must be an exhausted gas field already. What was it before it was called Sinksa?
For the record, John Burdick speaking. Chair Representative McKay, that's Kenai Cannery Loop.
Cannery Loop?
Mm-hmm. And to circle back on your initial question regarding Sinksa, per our lease agreement, we allow 18 billion cubic feet of total capacity for Sinksa itself, and seven BCF of that gas is just base cushion gas, but the workable moving gas is roughly 11 billion cubic feet.
11. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Chair McKay, for the record, John Crowther here. We just went back to our slide 5, and on the right side you can see a map, and indicated in what I would call a purple magenta color are the existing gas storage facilities, I believe, for the committee's reference.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. All right. Any other questions? Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair McKay. Johnny Meza for the record, Department of Natural Resources. After discussing the supply and demand of Cook Inlet gas, we're going to turn our attention now to an overview of the fiscal system that applied in Alaska, and specifically some elements of that fiscal system that affected Cook Inlet. In this graph, we will see two types of information. On the bar chart, you're going to see number of wells that were drilled in the Cook Inlet Basin, by category, the development wells, exploratory wells in yellow/orange, and stratigraphic wells. On top of that graph, we will see a description of the duration of the different fiscal systems that apply during this period, beginning with the economic limit factor up until 2006, transitioning into the production petroleum tax, beginning in April 2006 and lasting for almost a year, and then transitioning into ACES and then SB 21. These fiscal systems affected North Slope and Cook Inlet, but there are some elements to highlight with respect to Cook Inlet specifically. Some of them are related to the tax credits that were active during this period, and others that were instituted with the enactment of House Bill 280, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act in 2010, and how they were phased out, expired, or repealed with House Bill 247 in 2017. The main purpose of one of the key takeaways of this graph is to describe or paint the picture of how an entrant to the basin right now will face the fiscal system compared to what it was 10, 15 years ago with the existence of credits and the tax system applicable to Cook Inlet. Another element that we use in this slide in terms of association, but not necessarily as a cause and effect, is the number of exploratory wells that existed during the period where these tax credits were in place and no longer were the case once they were expired or phased out. And now we observe more stratigraphic wells or development wells. Exploratory activity will become important in a future slide where we talk about how much of the production comes from wells that were drilled in the past 20 years versus the ones that predated, were more older wells.
Okay, questions? Just to be clear, the yellow bars are the exploratory. So what you take home immediately is that there hasn't been many exploratory wells drilled since 2015. So, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Meza. So should I presume, again, a lot of these bills are familiar to me, but once passage of CIRA, did the previous exploration and capital expenditure and small producer credits, did those all expire when we went forward with the Coconut Recovery Act, or did they remain in effect, and do they remain in effect to this day?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe those remain in existence even with the enactment of the Coquindo Recovery Act, but they all expired or were phased out with the enactment of House Bill 247.
They did expire at 247?
Yes.
And then, thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Johnny Meza for the record, Department of Natural Resources. We're now going to look at this graph presenting information on the price of gas for two different markets. One is the prevailing value of Coquindo gas. That is the price reported by the Department of Revenue, representing a weighted average of the prices that producers in the inlet and local utilities arrive at, and it is presented in a quarterly basis. The other graph is the Henry Hub gas price, and Henry Hub is a destination hub in Louisiana and is also the connection point of various interstate and intrastate pipelines, and it represents the price assessment for spot and future gas contracts in the New York Mercantile Exchange. One key thing to note here is the different evolution of these prices because they represent different markets, one of them being more liquid and with a greater variety of suppliers and with more exposure to global factors such as demand for LNG, and the supply is not only generated to meet the demand in the local or regional consumption, but also to export to Europe and Asian markets. In contrast, the prevailing value of Coquindo gas mainly represents the dynamics of local producers and local buyers such as the utilities.
Okay, very quickly, Mr. Meza, are these numbers adjusted for inflation, or are they as they were at that time?
Chair McKay, they are nominal prices. They are not adjusted for
inflation. They're not adjusted for inflation, okay. All right, just want to make that clear. Any questions? Okay, please continue.
And as we mentioned before, Johnny Meza, Department of Natural Resources for the record. As we mentioned before, having seen the evolution of the exploratory wells in our previous slide, we thought it was very useful to present information regarding how much of the current production, and this is the bar chart on the right side of the slide. If we focus on the year 2021, we can see that 80% of the current production comes from wells that were drilled after 2000. And therefore, highlighting the impact of the declining production from older wells, those that were drilled before 2000, and the importance of exploratory activity to maintain a certain level of production in the basin.
Okay, thank you. One question that I might come up with is, of all the wells drilled, what was the ratio of success? In other words, if they drilled 20 wells, were 18 of them successful in finding gas, or do you have an idea what their success rate is? Like if we go out there next year and drill 10 wells, is there any correlation?
Chair McKay,
you understand the question?
Yes. Chair McKay, if it would be possible, we could come back with that answer after the presentation.
Okay.
For the record, John Burdick speaking.
John.
So I'm going to walk us through the studies that have been released by the Division of Oil and Gas starting in 2009. This study consisted of an engineering and geologic evaluation, and what it applied was a decline curve analysis and material balance engineering methods. Using publicly available data furnished by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and I'll note that as AOGCC going forward. What this particular study didn't address was economics of drilling additional wells, recompletions of existing wells, infrastructure optimizations, and as well as the ability to sell the gas into the Cook Inlet market. And what this study concluded was approved plus probable reserve estimate of approximately 1.1 trillion cubic feet. And advancing to 2011, this is more of a commercial application. And what this study did, it investigated investments required around various targeted reserves, and ultimately addressed commercial viability of remaining gas by coming up with conceptual plans in order to produce natural gas in the basin to meet an assumed demand at that time of 90 billion cubic feet per year.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
Thanks, Chair McCabe. So maybe this is a good place to ask this, or maybe you're going to get into it, but what's the current royalty rate for the gas in Cook Inlet, and is there some sort of a credit for new discoveries?
Johnny Mesa, for the record, Department of Natural Resources. Representative McCabe, through the chair. The royalty rate in Cook Inlet is 12.5%. Generally, the majority of those leases contain that royalty rate of 12.5%. In statute, there exists the ability for a company that discovers a field or a pool that wasn't discovered so far to apply for what we call the discovery royalty, which is a reduction in the royalty rate down to 5% for a period of 10 years. There is also in statute the ability to request for a reduction in royalty for various scenarios. One of them is to incentivize new production. Another one is for declining production to extend the life of the field. And another one is to bring back production for a field that was already shut in.
Paula?
Yeah, please, Rep. McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McKay. So through the chair, isn't there some fields that have been discovered and not developed, maybe down closer to Homer, that are being tied up with because of environmental stuff? And it might not be drilling right in the inlet. I think the drilling proposed is directional drilling from a few miles inland and down several thousand feet and then out into the field. Would those be covered under that new discovery, the 5% royalty for 10 years, or would they be audit right into the 12.5%?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, Johnny Mesa from the Department of Natural Resources. I would say they, in theory, they will qualify as a new investment if they were able to follow the language of the statute, which is to show in a clear and convincing way that such field is not economic without the reduction of the royalty rate. So there is a proof, a burden of the proof that an applicant will need to make, and if the operator believes that the field would need the reduction of the royalty rate to bring it online, then the Department of Natural Resources has that statute available to find if a reduction of the royalty rate is needed.
And one more, if you...
Okay, Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. Through the chair, so I'm curious. I mean, I'm looking at some charts further on down here that are pretty dire in their predictions, actually, for gas to Anchorage and other places. How big is that field off of Homer? Do you have any idea how many, if we added it into these charts that are coming up, I guess, would it change the outlook at all for availability of gas to South Central and other places in the state?
I know the field he's talking about. I think it's Cosmopolitan. Okay. I'll help you, Kevin.
The name escaped me. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Through the chair, John Burdick speaking. Representative McCabe, We don't have firm estimates, but we can provide technically recoverable estimates. I don't have them before me, but we can follow up with you on that.
That'd be great. And through the chair again, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Kevin.
I'm sorry to take over for you, Tom. But moving forward a couple slides to like page 18 and 19, which worry me greatly, frankly, because I have kids and grandkids that live in Alaska. Would it be possible when you find those to put that on this chart and see how it makes a difference for us? That might be a lot of work. I don't know, but if you can somehow correlate it to this annualized gas volume untruncated chart found on page 18 and show us what it would mean for us if we could develop that field.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it would be too premature at this point. For the scope of this study, we are honed in on approved reserve assessment. Roping in Cosmopolitan, for example, would be a technical reserves assessment, so it would be a geologically derived estimate, which would fall outside of the scope of this particular study.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
And I know that they have estimates for that field. The difficulty, Rep. McCabe, with that field is that the formations are shallow where the gas is, and the geometry is very, very difficult to reach it from shore. It's a geometry problem and would probably most easily require a platform to be set off of Anchor Point to get at that gas. So it's kind of it's very tantalizing. It's a big gas field. It's a beautiful field, but we can't reach it from shore. So it presents a different set of challenges. I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Mazin, Mr. Berlick, is to ask you, it seems to me that we have at least all the financial tools available to the DNR and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to do whatever needs to be done, at least from a financial point of view, to help exploration and development in Cook Inlet for gas. Is that a true statement generally, or do you need some more tools from the legislature to help this basin? Does that make sense?
Chair McKay, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Resources, for the record, and I'll take a stab at it, and I might turn it over to my erstwhile deputy here to clean up. I think, you know, certainly the state has a number of tools within its arsenal in which it can offer, you know, various incentives. The state, you know, also has the ability to go out and conduct some of our own, you know, geologic assessments, shoot seismic data, you know, do some preliminary sort of exploratory work that can help lower the risk and lower the costs for companies to understand what resources are available, help inform their decision making when it comes to prospective lease sales and otherwise. You know, getting to the question of actually, you know, bringing more gas on the market, you know, it really depends, and it varies by company. At this point in time, we really only have a couple of operators that are actually producing gas in the Cook Inlet. And some of our potential fields that we've discussed, like Cosmopolitan that Representative McCabe mentioned, you know, those projects, like as you rightfully point out, will, you know, require the installation of an offshore platform. And the costs of that, you know, are significant, in the hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, close to $500 million. So, you know, whether or not the state has the, you know, risk appetite to, you know, help underwrite or finance projects like that, you know, is a discussion, I suppose, that merits being had. But, you know, for other companies, it might not necessarily be as much of an issue of financial incentive. You know, some companies are constrained. You know, they just face normal capital constraints like all companies. They have, you know, different areas where they may operate, and those areas may compete for capital. And so it may be difficult for one company to justify spending a significant amount of capital in the Cook Inlet when there may be other areas that are more profitable, more economically attractive for them to invest their capital. So, you know, in those sorts of environments, you know, again, the sorts of tools that the state has available might be somewhat limited to help, you know, influence behavior. And lastly, I think another factor that merits some discussion is the fact that, you know, we have a fairly anemic support services industry that remains in the Cook Inlet. And you know, that's been an industry that's been in decline, you know, particularly as we've seen activity levels drop in the Cook Inlet. And so, you know, as your support services industry declines or you know, faces constraints, then that too has an impact on whether, you know, companies can have the manpower and the equipment and other accoutrements that they need in order to kind of go out and, you know, pursue an exploration project or you know, do more well work or you know, other activities of the like. So it's, you know, yeah, the state has tools. The legislature obviously has tools that it can bring to bear, but, you know, it really, the issue becomes a lot more nuanced when we have to take into account the different companies, the way that, you know, the constraints that those companies face and the actual factors that may or may not actually be within state control to help incent, you know, their activity to actually find and produce more gas.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Rep Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know you have a lot of slides to present, a lot of good background information, so I'll ask my question and hold your answer to the appropriate time, but I'd like your evaluation of whether the Cook Inlet Recovery Act was successful or effective as intended. Answer now or answer after you present the rest of your material. It's up to you. It's a broader question, I know.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, if I could ask my colleague to switch back to our slide depicting so as you can see from this slide, there's a couple trends that we can see that, as my colleague Johnny Meza mentioned, are not demonstrably causation, but are correlation. So one thing we can see on that slide is that there were significant exploration wells drilled in the time period that the Cook Inlet Recovery Act credits and other applicable terms were in place. Exploratory wells do not in and of themselves produce gas or guarantee the discovery of fields, but they're certainly a necessary step to discover gas and new fields. We did see some new fields that are in development today that were identified during that time. Those, you know, the activities to develop those fields were certainly influence, we could assume, by the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. Would they have occurred with or without it? We don't know that. But you can see similarly in that graph that after those credits were in place, the number of exploratory wells were significantly limited. And there are, I would note in this slide 7, what we call stratigraphic test wells. So you can almost see that instead of full cost exploratory wells, cheaper stratigraphic test wells were drilled by operators to try and characterize new resource, but provided what came at limited cost, provide limited information to guarantee or to provide a high likelihood of success of exploration. So I think we can say that the Cook Inlet Recovery Act supported exploration. That exploration resulted in some new development, but it is not guaranteed or clearly confirmed that but for the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, that exploration discoveries would have occurred. And I would, you know, the broader costs and benefits of monetizing those, I think, are beyond the scope of the department's immediate analysis.
And that would just follow up. I would note that, yeah, uh-huh. I understand that the correlation is not causation. That's up to us to draw our own conclusions, but I appreciate the precise answer. Thank you.
Okay, we better continue or we'll never get through this. Thank you, Rep. Sandler.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So going from 2011 to 2015, this was a 2015's update was a mere update of 2009 study Again, incorporating decline curve analysis and material balance applications using, again, publicly available data from AOGCC. This study did not address perspective, also known as undiscovered contingent, also known as discovered but not producing, nor 3P reserves. But what this study did conclude was approved plus probable reserve estimates of approximately 1.2 trillion cubic feet. And advancing to 2018, this study built on the three previous studies that I just mentioned. It incorporated future supplies by coming up with hypothetical development projects required to produce undeveloped volumes and estimate each project's economic viability. And really that came up with a range between 500 to 800 billion cubic feet of additional gas that would be economic to develop at the 2016 price range of roughly $6 to $8 per thousand cubic foot. And what the study arrived at was a P50 reserve estimate of 700 billion cubic feet when the price was at $8 per thousand cubic feet.
Okay, questions? Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. When we say economic to develop, what is the definition of economic to develop?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair. Joni Mesa from Department of Natural Resources. The definition of economic to develop in the context of that study referred to a conceptual development for some projects that produced, given some assumptions of price, produced a return to that investment high enough for the producer to bring that production online. So in more specifically, an internal rate of return of, let's say, 12% or 15%, a return on their investment.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions?
Just a
Rep. Mears, excuse me.
through the chair, is that determined by the company, or do they give that information to us for that determination on the internal rate of return?
Representative Mears, through the chair, that information is not provided by the companies. We've determined a blanket or one-size-fits-all approach in using what would be an acceptable return on their investment given that the degree of risk that is natural in the exploration of oil and gas and development of oil and gas. So with the level of risk where success is not guaranteed, investors will normally require a rather higher return on their investment than for other types of projects.
You know, basically, it's a hypothetical company, and you just plug it in and, you know, get an idea. Okay, please continue.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So this brings us to this current study. I know it says 2022 Kigenlink gas forecast, and that's merely that's when the forecast began, is beginning of 2022. And it really was a technical reserve assessment of 90 different oil and gas pools in Cook Inlet, as referred by AOGCC, using data obtained from AOGCC. And what this study incorporated was a decline curve analysis for currently producing well sets, as well as type curves in order to develop resource estimate volumes for future development wells. The contingent and prospective resources were not considered in this forecast, but using those two primary components of decline curve analysis and type curves, we estimated a field level economic limits that were ultimately incorporated in our truncated forecast case. The forecasted volumes do not account for gas produced from gas storage, so as to avoid duplicative gas volumes produced for sales. What the study did, we assumed a demand of 70 billion cubic feet per year, and we did not assume a future of additional requirements, nor does it assume possible substitutes for increasing efficiency and and consumption, both for energy producers and commercial or domestic producers.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, yes, a short one you said.
The short one I said, yes, sir, through the chair. So I don't see a total number, but I look on slide 15 where the truncated study is presented. So the results of this 2020 sine curve analysis will be reflected someplace in future. I think it's slide 15, but I'm kind of waiting for the what's the work. So I'll wait for 15.
Thank you.
You have to be patient, Rep. Sadler. So when I think about gas fields, I think about a balloon, and when you let the air out of the balloon, you know, the early part of the discharge has got a lot of force and a lot of push, and then it peters out, and, you know, it's just very low pressure. So without getting into petroleum engineering too heavy, how do you guys model, I guess I would call it blowdown? Like there's a point where you're losing pressure quite dramatically, and production. So I don't know, how do you address that in your forecast? If that's too complicated, let's move on. But
through the chair, McKay, that's a good question. That did fall outside of the scope of the study. It was purely a decline curve.
Okay, because you can't get every molecule of gas out. You're not going to get all of it. There's going to be a point where you stop. Okay, so that's kind of have to be dialed in somewhere. Okay, please continue.
Okay, slide 13. So this slide is really what was at the forefront of applying our assumption for our proved undeveloped volume category, and really we took a look back prior to 2019. And really, the reason we excluded years within the pandemic because we considered them mere outliers. But when you focus on the time frame of between 2009 to 2019, over the course of those years, the running average was approximately 15 development wells drilled per year.
Okay, please continue.
Johnny Mesa, Department of Natural Resources, for the record. On this slide, we're going to describe the framework that we undertook for providing an economic filtering of the resources that my colleague referred to, the gas resources coming from the decline curve analysis and the tight well curves. We wanted to reflect a economic principle that upstream companies are unlikely to operate their fields at a sustained loss. In that sense, we wanted to recognize that there will be a limit to the production of gas resources coming from those forecasts when the incremental revenues are no longer large enough to cover the incremental expenditures associated with that production. Once the operation of those fields reach that level, then any gas forecasted beyond that point, we believe it will no longer be available for the market for buyers. Such as local utilities. So we wanted to reflect that principle in the economic filtering of that gas resource forecast. To do that, we considered obviously the production forecasted for those gas resources, but also the revenue side in the sense that we took into account the profile of prices that were publicly available coming from the multi-year contracts between some producers in Cook Inlet and the local utilities. We also applied a one-size-fits-all approach regarding cost, but accounting for differences in the proximity or location with respect to infrastructure for different fields. So offshore fields will tend to experience a higher cost than onshore fields, those on the western side versus those on the eastern side. Related to a previous question we received before, we need to account the royalty payments that those fields need to provide to the royalty owners, such as the state of Alaska, and also private royalty interest owners, and as well as production tax and oil and gas property tax.
Okay, please continue.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So slide 15, this is going to be first of a number of forecast charts that we'll be showing you today. And what you see is a rate versus time plot. And this is our untruncated case, so no economics being factored. And what you can see is sort of a sawtooth fashion profile, and really what that represents is the assumed 15 development wells per year drilled, and you can obviously see that in a staggered fashion, and really what we found for our untruncated case, we arrived at a high case of approximately 1.4 trillion cubic feet, all the way down to 843 billion cubic feet for our low case. In our mean case, we arrived at 1.1 trillion cubic feet.
Okay, thank you.
And advancing to slide 16, this is the same rate based plot, rate versus time, but this is the impacts of when we factor in economics. And our high case arrived at 1.1 trillion cubic feet, all the way down to 603 billion cubic feet for our low case, with a mean case arriving at 820 billion cubic feet, which we'll refer to that number later in the presentation. And I'll hand it over to my colleague, Mr. Meza, for additional comments.
So just so we're all clear, the sawtooth portion of both of these graphs means 15 wells per year, new wells drilled. And then in 2030, you stop that. Is that correct, Mr. Burdick?
That's correct. Any years beyond that became very uncertain at that point. And it's based on information that we received from all operators that operate in the Cook Inlet.
Okay. Rep. Sadler?
Is that exploratory wells or production wells?
Development wells on production.
Through the
Chair, Sadler.
Sorry. Chair McCade, just to provide additional information for the committee, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. The assumption that wells, 15 wells per year, would be drilled for the next, through the end of the decade, through 2030, we've viewed as reasonable in light of existing contractual commitments by operators, existing development plans from operators. It's certainly possible, and one could even say likely, that some development wells would continue to be drilled after that time period under the existing assumptions in the study. We just didn't include that or model it because of uncertainty about how, if 15 was a reasonable number or what the trend might be.
Hmm. Okay. And then obviously this is no new discoveries. Is that fair?
That's correct, Chair McCain.
Okay, just trying to make it real clear for the public and everybody else. Okay, please continue, guys.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So slide 17. So what you're seeing is a zoom in of the forecast, and really what we incorporated the actual data from January 2022 through October 2022. And as you can see, it falls within the band. So the band meaning our high case and our low case. And any production, actual production that would fall above our high case or below our low case would be very, very low probability of that occurring. But there's a high certainty of when actual data will fall within that band. And as you can see, it hugs very well within our mean and our mid case.
Hmm. Okay, any questions? All right, continue, please.
So slide 18, so this is a similar but different chart represented in the form of a billion cubic feet per year. So and this is our untruncated case, technically recoverable resources. And what we did, we used our assumed 70 billion cubic feet per year overlaid on our annualized gas volume cases. And again, this is our untruncated case, so no economics factored.
Yeah. Okay, any questions? No, we're picking up speed. Okay, please continue.
So advancing to slide 19, same plot, just with economics factored in. And I'll hand it over to my colleague, Johnny Meza, for additional comments.
Thank you. Johnny Meza from Department of Natural Resources. I would like to note in this graph here that this comes from the results of applying that economic filter we referred to in an earlier slide. Now, in that slide, we described assumptions or a one-size-fits-all approach for costs. That's one of the reasons is because we don't have visibility into the detailed structure of the cost of production from fields in Cook Inlet. So naturally, if we were to modify some of our assumptions regarding costs, the height of those bars may very well change. Now, by coming from the forecast of gas resources coming from the decline curve analysis and type well curves representing the proved developed and proved undeveloped components of that forecast, there is in the absence of additional discoveries or new fields contributing to the supply of gas, we noted that there will be some gap in if the demand profile for cooking the gas were to be maintained at 70 billion cubic feet per day, per year. I'm sorry.
Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Just through the chair, I guess, Johnny. So for reference, again, the annual demand exclusive of the Nikiski plant, exclusive of Nutrim, this is just kind of civilian consumer and commercial request or demand. That's 80 billion cubic feet a year of natural gas from Cook Inlet. Is that about right?
70.
Okay, good. Yeah, I want to clarify this. And if I can follow up again with my question. Yeah, could you generally, just when you say with the economics factored in, what does that mean? That's just a price variable?
Representative Sattler, through the chair, yes. We wanted to reflect the economic principle that producers will maintain production to the extent that they can recover their production costs through their revenues. And when that no longer is possible due to, let's say, the declining level of production of a rising level of cost, then they will no longer operate and avoid those losses, and that's the economic filter.
And Chair McKay, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, if I could just provide a little bit more information for the committee to contextualize this. An important assumption in this study is that prices remain roughly equivalent to where they are now, subject to an inflationary increase. So another way to look at this chart is, with prices maintaining a relatively stable rate, economics, the revenues associated with development will start to materially affect the development in the later years of this decade. Now, it's very reasonable in the real world, prices may not remain stable. That may change development incentives, the supply available. So it is this chart is presented in light of the assumptions in the study. But, of course, price is a very important assumption, both because of its consumer impacts and because of the economics that it translates into for developers.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
For the record, John Burdick speaking.
Oh, sorry. Representative Rauscher had a question. I'm sorry, George.
Yeah, so these graphs are all, they're all contingent upon the demand being the same. So as we introduce renewables into the equation for energy usage, these will all change and the supply will be greater. Is that what we're to gather out of what you got here?
Representative Rashra, yes. To clarify one of the assumptions in the study, there is not any assumed amount of demand or supply switching resource switching driven by either supply security or cost. If there were other supplies of natural gas, if there were other sources of energy in the rail belt, it's entirely possible that the demand associated, which is assumed in the study to be flat, would decrease for Cook Inlet natural gas, and that would have changes to both supply available over time, price, and other items depicted in these charts.
Basically, that 70 billion would start to go down if other things took its place. Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. Has there been any modeling or studies done to show how we can supplement different types of renewable in this region? So if we start to see that delta beginning in 2027, is there anywhere I can look to understand if we put in X, Y, and Z, community solar, wind, other projects, how that might be able to supplement the lack of gas?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, I believe there's a variety of organizations and institutions studying those kinds of questions. The department, for purposes of this forecast, is looking solely at the development of Cook Inlet natural gas and, you know, with several important assumptions in the study to provide technical information about the recovery and development of those Cook Inlet fields.
If I can help Rep. Armstrong on Thursday in the Energy Committee, we'll be having, I think it's Chugach Electric, Matanuska Electric, and the other electric providers, and they are looking at wind energy and solar and other renewables that would help fill the gap. So on Thursday at the Energy Committee, you can see some of that. Yes, Rep. Mears.
So to clarify, and maybe you can even answer this, who's looking out for our total energy supply? Is there's not a State Department doing that. It's the Energy Committee within the legislature that's looking at that total amount of energy we have to look at, our total portfolio.
Yes, and that was my concern when we first saw this last week, was who is actually looking out for everybody? Because, you know, you have the DNR and what they do, and then you have the gas explorers and producers like Hillcorp, and then you have NSTAR, who delivers gas for our furnaces and other, and then you have the electric companies. So it is a little bit scattered. And one of the comments I made was to make sure that somebody's kind of bringing that all together so that we don't end up in a situation where, oh, I thought you were going to drill those gas wells. Well, I thought you were going to put in the windmills. Well, I thought you were going to, you know, do something else, right? So it kind of does, you're exactly right. I think it does have to be a unified effort so that nothing slips through the crack and that we have solid energy for the rail belt for a long time. Commissioner, would you agree with that?
Chair McKay, absolutely. And I just wanted to add that, you know, the governor has created within his cabinet the Office of Energy Innovation. And so the governor has people that are specifically tasked to looking at these sorts of issues from more of a holistic standpoint, not just from the aspect of a resource owner like DNR, but looking at all available options. Because, you know, as many of you heard, you know, one of the governor's top priorities is securing low-cost energy for Alaskans, which does involve looking at renewables, involves looking at geothermal, tidal, you know, opportunities for, you know, increased hydroelectric generation, you know, things of that nature. So there are folks, you know, even within the administration that are looking at it. Even within DNR, you know, we have our division of geological and geophysical surveys. Those are the folks that go out and can map and model, you know, where geothermal resources are, things of that nature. So I know, you know, we as a department are also looking into what other options are available that, you know, can help provide energy for Alaskans in the medium and long term.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Please continue.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So slide 20, it's a similar graph to the previous graphs, but a couple of key differences. One, we are isolating to just our mean case, and really it's broken out in the proved developed volumes stacked on top of the proved developed is our incremental proved undeveloped volumes. And we use, again, the assumed 70 billion cubic feet per year as a benchmark. But really a key take point on this slide for our untruncated case is the impact for continued development drilling, as you can see in the gray bars.
Okay, please continue.
Slide 21, this is our truncated case, and I'll hand it over for additional comments to Mr. Mesa.
Thank you. Johnny Mesa, Department of Natural Resources, for the record. In this slide, as my colleague referred to, this is showing information of the forecasted gas that is economic to, or expected to be economic to produce, and disaggregating that by two layers, one of the proof developed cases and on the orange component of that bar, the contribution to the gas supply in the Cook Inlet Basin coming from the assumption of 15 additional wells drilled each year.
Okay, Rep. Armstrong.
Thanks. I just wanted to follow up on a few questions and something the commissioner said earlier, just to make sure I have total understanding. So essentially, we have we think 820 billion cubic feet, which shows us running out with what we know at 2041. I'm assuming since it's not economically viable for us to hit 70 billion in even just a few years, that potentially exploring for more isn't economically viable. Are we looking at like 2041 is when it drops off and we need to have a full replacement by then? Or maybe you can shed some light there in case I'm misunderstanding.
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, John Crowther, deputy commissioner. So I believe the depiction of 2041 is just the scope included in our study. It's conceivable there'd be production beyond that point. And so I wouldn't read too much into that number. And additionally, this study displays the development of currently producing and currently assessed, currently identified reserves. And so the chart we are looking at here, slide 21, shows that the economics of developing those two categories with the assumptions that we have about price are challenged within a decade. That does not automatically mean that exploration is economically challenged, but some of the same things that drive costs of development also drive costs of exploration, such as the commissioner identified, constrained service industry, you know, that it's needed to drill exploration wells, limited access to capital, a need for a rate of return within an identified time frame. And so it is fair to assume that the cost factors that are assumed in the study would also affect exploration, but that does not mean that no exploration would occur. It's just that we did not try and identify that exploration trend as part of this forecast.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah, this slide is pretty important, I think, folks, for, you know, in oil and gas industry terms, you know, 3 or 4 years is not very long. So, and, you know, from what I know, we get a lot of our minerals and supplies for renewable energy from China. Solar panels, windmills, all the materials to do a lot of that renewable work currently comes from China. So if something happened where that went away, you could be in a position where this graph becomes quite real. And this is why we were asking questions about CINGSA, bringing in LNG, and other ways to fill this gap so that, frankly, the rail belt, which is approximately 3/4 of the state's population, doesn't have energy shortage problems. So I wanted to kind of focus on this for that reason. Okay? All right, please continue.
For the record, John Burdick speaking. So slide 22. So this is just a comparison of the previous studies that I had mentioned in the beginning of our presentation and how it compares to this current study. And what you see in the gray bar is just cumulative gas produced at the time of that particular study. And on top of that, in the red, is our total estimated reserves. And again, you can see that number of our mean case of approximately 820 billion cubic feet. And when you add both of those, both the bar, or I'm sorry, the gray and the red bar, you come up to an estimated ultimate recovery of approximately 9.7 trillion cubic feet. And really what distinguishes between each of these studies, despite it, there may not be any material change by the eye, but really, each of these studies incorporated different methodologies, different scopes of work that address certain scenarios within that time of study. So that's just more of what you can that's the main takeaway from each of these studies, that it doesn't really move the needle a whole lot, but ultimately there are different methods incorporated for each respective study.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Okay, slide 23, I believe this is our last slide. And really, this is just speaking to the undiscovered resources within the Cook Inlet. And two distinct studies, distinct yet separate studies, one by USGS, and really, if you focus on the bullets, second and the third bullet, when you combine those mean conventional, mean unconventional, you get approximately 19 trillion cubic feet of technically recoverable gas. And south of that USGS study that I just mentioned, this study conducted by BOEM, they arrived at a undiscovered technical recoverable gas volume of approximately 1.2 trillion cubic feet of additional mean resource gas.
So the recent sale where Hillcorp was the only bidder, where on this map would those leases lie? If you could, is it possible to just give us an idea?
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Chair McKay, for the record, this is John Crowther. So at the end of last year, there were two lease sales, one in state waters and one in federal waters. The one in federal waters is what was referenced in the bottom of this slide. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management manages the federal Outer Continental Shelf. And so they held, per the provisions of federal law, a lease sale in the federal waters of Cook Inlet. So on the south of that map, actually kind of where it says Cook Inlet. And roughly where, somewhere in the word inlet, I believe, just to the right, is the federal lease that Hillcorp acquired. And that is adjacent to some existing federal leases that they currently own. Hillcorp also participated in the state lease sale at the end of last year, where they acquired, I believe, five leases. It's very difficult to see on that map, but there's a little island almost due west of the Soldotna. They acquired two leases there, and then they acquired three leases, I believe, a little bit south of the dot indicating Beluga onshore. All of those Hillcorp leases are in the offshore.
So that one to the south where it says the word inlet, that's actually brushing up close to Cosmopolitan. It seems like an anchor point.
Chair McCabe, in terms of physical proximity, that is in the vicinity, yes.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, kind of for the public listening, so to compare chart 22 and 23, I'll draw some conclusions. We see that there's been about 9.7 trillion cubic feet of gas produced by Cook Inlet to date. And then the next slide shows us that there is conventional undiscovered but technically recoverable gas of 13.7 trillion, and if the non-conventional works, there's another 1.2 trillion. So there's more gas there than we've used to date since the 650s. It's a matter of spending the money to drill it and discover it and try and have a company make enough money. And that's kind of our problem, is not necessarily the geologic limitation, but the economic limitations. Is that a pretty fair summation?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the record. That's correct. You know, there is a significant amount of resource, you know, still available in the Cook Inlet. But again, you know, one of the challenges for, you know, a company is that, it may cost hundreds of millions of dollars to go out and explore and bring a new platform online that, you know, could ultimately, you know, develop some of this gas. And then the other constraint that you're left with is that South Central also has a very more or less fixed demand for gas. So, you know, that 70 BCF that we're looking at every year, if you discover a lot more than that, it actually doesn't do you any good necessarily as a company, because there's only so much that you can sell into the market in a given year. So because the market is so constrained, it doesn't offer a lot of economic incentives to go out and want to spend a lot of money looking for gas, because you're really limited to the amount that you can sell in a given year anyway, which of course puts more pressure on the economics to try to maximize, you know, the return that you get for those, you know, molecules of gas that you can actually sell into the market. So, you know, that's likely one of the reasons why, you know, when we hold these sales, you know, we're not seeing, you know, dozens of companies. We're not even seeing any really new companies wanting to come in and enter the space, because it really doesn't provide an attractive, you know, environment to invest. Based on the constraints and the and the, you know, relatively small magnitude of our energy market in South Central.
Rep. Armstrong, it looks like you're getting ready to, you're like hovering.
You know me well.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair McKay, through the chair. Now I lost my question. Hang on. It was a follow-up. Sorry. We used to export. At what level does it become economically viable to export? So if they did find a huge, well, there's 13 trillion and they're able to produce triple what we need. Let's say we need 70, so 210, I guess. Where does it like shake out that it becomes viable for a company to enter the space, I guess is what I'm asking.
Representative Armstrong through the chair. I think that's a great question. I don't know that we can answer it with any great specificity. When you're looking to export, obviously you need to have a big quantity, because in most, you know, the global LNG market is generally underpinned by long-term contracts. Now that has been shifting in recent years, where we are seeing both shorter-term contracts and also a lot more players interested in sort of playing the spot market. But generally, when you're exporting LNG, you're entering into contracts with large-scale consumers, generally in Asia, that are willing to offer you, you know, a price for, you know, usually terms of 30 years. And so, you know, to be able to have the amount of gas to compete in that space, you know, you need to have a lot of gas, which is part of the impetus behind the AKLNG project, right? There's a tremendous amount of gas available on the North Slope. There's, you know, very little risk in terms of how much gas we have, because we know how much we have in that we've been cycling it for decades. So one, you know, you have to have that large quantity, and two, you have to have, you know, what's called a competitive cost of supply. So that is, you know, the cost that it takes me to produce my LNG here in Alaska and, you know, put it on a ship and send it, for instance, to a consumer in Asia. That cost of supply needs to be competitive with what it might cost somebody in Australia or Papua New Guinea or Qatar or Russia or some other country, you know, where they're also producing LNG and exporting it to those markets. So there's a lot of, you know, factors that need to come into play.
Thank you. That was a great answer to what I know is a big and kind of complicated question. So I appreciate the insight.
Okay. Any other questions? It's been a fascinating presentation. I want to thank all four gentlemen for not fighting over the mics and being very cooperative with one another. And we really appreciate it. I think this is a really interesting situation, and I really appreciate our committee members looking at it closely and continuing to do so. So in closing, I'd like to say thank you to the DNR staff for making the trip down to see us today. I think this is a critical issue that merits much further discussion. As a committee, we should be considering every available policy tool to address it. I'll also state that there is an open invitation for our industry partners, public utilities, and other impacted organizations to come before this committee and provide additional information for us to consider. And Representative Armstrong, we will be looking into seeing if we can get a presentation from the Governor's Department of Energy Innovation, I promise you. So are there any other comments here from the committee members? All right. Rep. Dybert. Okay.
Through the chair, thank you. Since the news came out last week, are you getting a lot of phone calls and comments and emails of worry from folks in Anchorage, businesses? Or will there be second question, sorry, hearings, like hearings on this where there's public comment?
Representative Dybert, through the chair, I don't believe our office has received significant public input, and I think there has been, prior to our testimony last week in the Senate, additional media reporting about the broader issue of cook inlet supply, the utilities' efforts to contract and identify gas. And so I think there's been public discussion over the last maybe 6-9 months of this issue framed in these terms. Certainly the department's providing this information to be another input data point for the public. And, you know, we do expect people may reach out to us either with questions about our information or with comments about potential activities or paths forward. But we haven't seen a tremendous amount of that yet. And to your second question as to whether there will be opportunities for hearings with public comment, I don't want to speak too specifically, but the RCA Regulatory Commission of Alaska regularly has dockets for the utilities when they identify contracts that they may enter into or they identify needs for gas. And so the public may be able to participate through that process in that agency as well.
Okay. Rip McCabe.
Thanks, Chairman McKay. So the thing we need to remember, I think, is we're not just talking about heat here. Natural gas supplies supply 100% other than the standby power for the generators for MEA, say. And so it's bigger than just heating our homes. It's in fact, it's a lot bigger with the generation of electricity that comes from it. So I think we just need to kind of keep that in mind. I get the $70 billion, CF stuff, but, just something for us to keep aware. And so I appreciate your comments about the additional sources of electricity. Doesn't seem really appropriate here, but it actually is in this presentation. So thanks.
Okay. That concludes today's business. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, February 8th. Please note that we will all be in this room for the DNR Finance Subcommittee at noon on Wednesday. The next standing committee will begin directly after the subcommittee adjourns. Okay, any other business? All right, seeing none, this committee is adjourned at 2:28.